welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. I am truly delighted to share this conversation with you. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and for me, it's right at the leading edge. I'm joined today by Nadia Taranchewski, and we're going to be exploring source and money and the relationship between them. Source is a person who initiates a project or an idea, and they are connected to that sourcing energy. In a sense, they maybe have channeled or downloaded this project, this business. And so we're going to explore how we can tend to that sourcing, how we can tap into it. What are some of the common ways that sourcing gets corrupted or co-opted inside of projects and organizations? And what happens when we do? And what happens when we really open that channel and own that channel of being a source? And we'll also explore how that connects to money. As Nadia talks about, money is one of the most important doorways into our evolution, and it's particularly important for our times. And so we'll explore some of the common ways that we are unconsciously projecting onto money, the ways we are patterned with certain beliefs around money and how that limits us and how we can liberate ourselves from them and what happens between money and source as we do so. Incredibly rich conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Nadia is the founder of ConsciousU.com, where she runs programs around working with money, working with source, amongst other programs. Nadia has been deeply immersed in the work of Peter Koenig and is innovating the application of his work inside of leadership development and organizations. She's a master certified coach working with leaders globally and the author of ConsciousU, Become the Hero of Your Own Story. All right, let's dive in. Here is the podcast with Nadia Taranchewski. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. Is the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do, and it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Nadia, I was just saying as we were kind of checking in that I'm particularly excited for this conversation as I've discovered your work and read about source and money. And so we're going to be exploring that as a topic today. I've already shared one of your articles with our team and said, hey, we need to talk about this. So how are you doing, first of all?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about this conversation because our pre-conversation was already so rich that I am, very curious where this will take us.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Well, actually, I think a good place to start would be to talk about source and money and then explore the connection between that'll probably organically start to happen as well. And why that's so important for our times. And, I know your work is being really well received by different communities around the world. So what do you mean by source, first of all? Yeah, what is that?
So, let me start by naming the source of this type of work, right? So, yes, it is my work now as well, but it is, we all are based on the shoulders of giants and thinkers before us. So the person who was actually the person who first observed these principles of source, as he calls them, is a gentleman by the name of Peter Koenig. And he's been my mentor and friend now for more than 20 years. And Peter, to give you a bit of context of how was this even received, right? So he was one of the first generation of organizational development consultants, if you want. So he's been doing this work for 40 years. There wasn't a name for what he did back then, but he lives in Switzerland and he has worked with a lot of family-run businesses in Switzerland over the years. And he said one thing that he observed in all of these team sessions and family sessions around, where's this company going, was that there were always the same two breaking points. One was money, and we might touch upon that hopefully later because it's an important topic. And the other breaking point or friction point was what he ended up calling source, which is really about creative authorship. So the question of where did this thing that we now call a company or project or an initiative, where did it originate? And what Peter observed is that contrary to a lot of the narratives that we like to tell today, for example, where we have, like in my company, we have three founders, right? And the narrative that we like to tell is, well, we developed this thing together. And Peter, sort of by observing how people organize and how anything actually comes into existence, said, maybe that's not the most helpful narrative to tell because it's actually not true. There is usually, well, or in his viewpoint, there's always one person and one person only who is the source of an endeavor, an initiative, a company, a project. And the way he talks about it really made sense to me when I, when I first started having these conversations with him, because he said, it's a bit like in nature, like a tree doesn't grow out of three seeds at the same time, right? There is one seed that seeds the tree. And so source doesn't have anything to do with ego, but it does have something to do with hierarchy, and that hierarchy is time-based. So one thing came before the other. And in the origin of the word hierarchy, because I know in our generation at any rate, and certainly in the generations, below us, there is this nearly allergy against the word hierarchy, right? We want to move away from that because we've made such painful experiences with hierarchies in our families and at school and in some of the companies we worked for. We want to transcend hierarchy. And the understanding we now share in sort of our sort of Peter Koenig enriched circles is actually the natural root of the word hierarchy is sacred order. Right. And if we see hierarchy as just simply that there is a sacred order that describes the becoming of something, the unfolding, the emergence, the pattern behind that, then it's not so threatening anymore. So Source, from this perspective, points to a person who, sometimes I joke, who was the person who was in the wrong place at the wrong time and received a download from, wherever. Like we could even say there is this incredible field of limitless potential. And then suddenly it finds a channel, and that channel is the person who downloads an idea or a vision. Right. And often when you work with entrepreneurs, for example, I find that very often, if they were the originating source, not if they've inherited it from, previous family members, but if they sourced something, they often have this origin story where they just sort of know this was the beginning point, right? That was the creative impulse or spark that kickstarted this whole thing. And I remember, for example, very clearly when I received, I would even say, conscious you, right? I was sitting in a cafe and I had this moment of, I need to write this down. And then I sat there and I wrote for 2 hours. And more or less, what we're doing now with conscious you was received in that moment. But we're also very clear that Source, it's personal and impersonal at the same time, right? It's personal because I was the first channel through which this information flowed. So it is clearly filtered through my network of values and in experiences. So there is a personal note to it. But at the same time, it's impersonal because I can pass this on, right? So I'm much more like a guardian for a certain period of time. And if and when I feel I'm ready to move on, or maybe this field needs something else, I can pass the baton. I can pass the torch to somebody else and really let go of this. And if I were to give it to you, for example, and we do this succession process properly, then you are the source of this. And then you know best what needs to happen within this particular field. And we can go into more details, but maybe that suffices as sort of a first description.
Yeah, there's so many questions bubbling up. I recognize in my own life those moments where, something just came through and, effortlessly, and then suddenly it was like, wow, look at this. This is it. This has a kind of transmission to it. Like the essence of something is contained within inside of this, whatever it is, if it's written or spoken out. And so I just want to pick up on something you shared, which is fascinating to me, where you say that in a sense, there's a download taking place and we're maybe connecting to this field beyond us. And at the same time, it's ours, in the sense that it comes through us and there's something unique. But at the same time, it's kind of universal, or it's, we don't own it. And could you say more about what you think is what is actually going on there? Because I think that's actually a profoundly important insight to the kind of leadership that maybe is being invited in our times, where it is both. It's not like a bypass where it's like, oh, there is no self here, no individual person. But it's also not egotistical, like I'm going to own this thing and it's all mine and I want to be seen for it. So I wonder how you perceive that dynamic.
I think we're still in the process of understanding that ourselves, but the best way for me to describe it is if I'm sourcing something, I become a channel for information, right? Or as you called it, there's a transmission. And that's very much how I've experienced and how I've seen it in other people who have sourced something. I think that capacity to receive a transmission is in principle open to any of us, right? Because I think it connects to our developmental purpose, if you want, which is becoming or unfolding into our highest potential, right? And the transmission is potentially part of that because it guides us on this process of unfolding, of becoming. So if we're open to that, it will guide us to where we need to go. Where friction is created, and so interestingly, what I've also observed is in the fields that sources create, the people who feel attracted into this field often have very fine antennas for when are you speaking from this grounded place of connection to this channel, and when are you just talking from, from ego and wanting something because you want this now. There's a very subtle but very distinct energy that is connected to both of these places. And quite often, when a source is connected very well to this channel of information and they have built the right culture around them, what actually happens is that from the outside, everything looks like a collective process because the alignment in the field is so complete that there is 99% of the time no resistance in the field because everybody just goes, yeah, no, that feels right. Right? So from the outside, it looks like we made this decision together. Whereas when a source is, hasn't done their inner work because, of course, there are, sources out there who've sourced amazing things, but they have not developed their own internal landscape sufficiently. So they actually drop into ego quite a lot. Then you see that there are a lot of power struggles. Sources who haven't done the inner work tend to have a pattern between abandonment and micromanagement. Right? So they're either gone and not available for people in the field who need guidance at this particular moment in time, or they drop into micromanagement and get involved in levels of detail that are sort of totally beyond the scope of what they should be involved in. And that creates a lot of tension in the field, and nobody actually really knows, what are my limits of autonomy? What can I decide here? What can't I decide here? So, ego-driven fields feel very different from somebody who has really developed a deep understanding of themselves, who can notice the difference, even within myself, like where am I speaking from? And I can train my capacity to notice. Is that coming from a deeper knowing, or is that just coming from just because I want it?
Yeah, beautiful. Because you kind of took my next question on there, which is, this is important to me in Coaches Rising that we connect to this sense of, or I connect to this sense of source, and I'm hearing therefore that the source, it's actually important that they're A, doing their inner work, to be able to be a conduit for that, a vessel for source. And also, they're actually making space to connect to that sense of sourcing frequency as being really essential for leadership. Could you say a little bit more about the kinds of, you actually named it there, but the kinds of modes of being or practices that would help someone as a source to be able to do it, to perform better as a source, yeah.
Well, I loved what you said about the conduit, right? So there is, what is the work that I need to do to make sure that my channel is open for transmission in a way, right? And maybe let me introduce a metaphor here that I find very helpful in my coaching work. So I always think of this metaphor of that we were all born with an inner house. And, if you imagine this inner house to be a bit of a Harry Potter-esque creation, right? So it has the capacity for shifting floor plans and walls are never quite where you expected them. And not all rooms are, technically speaking, really rooms. Some of them are wide open fields or windows into the universe, whatever. But when you were a child, when I was a child, we had the capacity to run through this inner house with utmost and complete abandon. And in every room, we would meet a different human quality. And, Some of these rooms in this inner house are big ballrooms, others are small, tiny, intimate spaces, and we have nooks and crannies and hallways, and everything is part of this inner house. And we would run into one room where we would be, delighted and full of happiness. And then a second later, we bump our knee and everything is a big drama and the whole world is pain. Then we see a butterfly and we're fascinated by this butterfly and we're full of curiosity. Then we see an ice cream truck and we're like, oh my God, it's all craving and want. And I want this ice cream truck. Then we get drop into generosity because we want a kid that can't afford an ice cream to also have an ice cream. Then we're on the playground and we want the shovel that the other kid has. So we become really greedy and protective of what we feel is ours. So children have this permeability where because they have no attachment to any of these states of being and no judgment about them either, they just move in and out. Yeah, and if you've ever been around a toddler, within 2 minutes they've been in eight different rooms, right? It just goes so fast. But then of course we're domesticated by our parents, peer groups, teachers, our culture, and we begin to track that to our environment, not all of these rooms are equal, right? Because in some rooms, when I step in them, I get attention, I get recognition, I get applause, I get love. And then there are other rooms where I get ignored, I get ridiculed, I get punished, or maybe I even get hurt. So the smart little child that I am, I begin to say, okay, clearly not all rooms are equal because there are good rooms where all the good stuff happens and there are bad rooms. So what do? I begin to lock off the bad rooms and I say, I'm just not going to go there anymore because what's the point? And to remind myself to not step into the bad room, I also put this police tape over it, that says sort of yellow and in yellow and black, do not cross, right? Just to remind myself that's not a good room. Just don't step in there. But the trouble is that by the time I'm 30, my house looks, excuse my French, like a fucking crime scene, right? Because most of the house is taped off and, and there are all these warning signals and I can't step here and I can't step there. And the only rooms that I still have left are sort of three or four rooms that have proven to be developmentally safe spaces for me. But that means that most of my life energy is actually now invested into either not stepping into one of the quote unquote bad rooms or making sure that other people do not see that I have these bad rooms, right? So it's all impression management becomes incredibly performative. And there's no, my life energy doesn't flow anymore. So the inner work that I feel we have to do as sources is to re-inhabit, rediscover first, and then re-inhabit all of these inner rooms, right? And to accept all of our humanity, because when I'm able to do that, I will be much less triggered by other people and their inner rooms. I can take much more ownership and accountability for how I show up in the world. And going back to your conduit metaphor, I become a conduit for information that flows through this inner house. So that's what I feel is the practice that we need to do as sources.
Beautifully articulated, and it evokes in me a kind of if I think about, if I zoom out a little bit and I look at our world, and a theme on our podcast has been the transition we're in, which is, of course, we don't really know where we're going. You can't say where we're going to end up, but it seems like we're transitioning out of a kind of dominant materialist paradigm, which has, atomized experience into fixed parts and brought with it amazing scientific innovations, but perhaps disconnected us from certain creative, collaborative capacities, and that there's a journey into, a kind of post-materialist, processed-oriented experience where, people are now interested in doing this inner work, integrative work, and attuning to this field in ways that could create the kind of innovations and ways of collaborating that help us meet some of the challenges we're facing. I'm sure people have been doing this for thousands of years at the same time too. So, I don't want to denigrate what's the amazing things that have already happened and the lineages we've inherited as well.
Actually, on that note, I just over the weekend I watched something that brought me to tears. I watched an interview between Mamdani and Bernie Sanders, right? And they actually filmed this before Mamdani won the elections to be the next New York mayor. And Mamdani just interviewed Sanders about his experience of being a mayor for 8 years himself, and how he ran his campaign back then, and what they ended up doing to make him so successful, what his recipe was. And of course, it was really not rocket science. It was sort of listen to the community, go talk to the people on the ground, change the things that pain them the most, like childcare, like actually cleaning the streets in the winter for especially in poorer neighborhoods so that people can get to work. So it was a bunch of really simple things like creating a music festival involving artists, creating spaces for the youth to meet and to connect. And so he lists a number of things, and it brought me to tears for two reasons. Because one was that I thought, oh my God, we've already had all of these spaces, right? How come that something that takes 8 years to build is then dismantled within 6 months, right? And why do we continue doing this? And I think it's due to a lack of inner work, right? It's when against all the evidence that that makes for happier societies, I'm triggered by my own insecurity and my own greed. Then I dismantle things that work in this way. But also it brought me to tears because I thought, well, it's been done before, so it can be done again, right? So we have the tools, we know how this works, and there are examples all over the world for communities, for organizations, for initiatives that are run in different ways. We just have to use them.
Yeah, beautiful. Which is hopeful, because it's like we know about this. It's within our culture. Let me just clear up a couple of questions, and then we might pivot to money and then look at the connection. I'm presuming, therefore, you think it's a good idea that the sourcing energy, the sourcing person in a project, is able to own that role. And maybe sometimes people don't own that role, and this points to the inner work, and that they create the conditions whereby they can attune to that sourcing, sense of sourcing as it moves through them. And I'm wondering about that. How do we know when we're tuning in to source? I mean, I guess the answer is because it's just
No,
self-evident,
seriously,
but
it's a little bit like falling in love, right? It's where, yeah, how do you know that you've fallen in love? Well, you just kind of know, right?
and there's a sense of pride, like knowing, inspiration, passion, creativity, all those words point to that sense of being attuned to it. And could you say something about transference of sourcing? So you said like there are ways in which that can not happen properly, and for example, if a new CEO steps into an organization, what's important in transferring that sourcing properly?
Well, again, the magic word, of course, is consciousness, right? So the more conscious this process is handled, the better it is for the entire field. So quite often what we see in organizations is that source is actually not transferred in the best way, that succession hasn't really taken place. So the source might leave. So for example, a very public example was when Steve Jobs was first ousted from Apple. But he still held source, right? So he might have not had the majority shares anymore. He might have in the power hierarchy of the organization, he might have not played a role for quite some time. But in terms of the energetic transmission for what this company needed to be, it was still him. And it also points to what we said earlier, you can be an amazing source without actually being a good leader. Right. So the stories, I mean, I never obviously never met the guy personally, but I think there are definitely some shadow sides in his leadership, because there were some aspects of his inner house that were not discussable, that were not where there was little awareness about how he was as a person showing up in that space. But he was still an amazing source. So that's maybe something to know as well, is that leadership and source are not necessarily connected. I mean, they are and they aren't, right? But you can be a source without being a leader, and you can be a leader without being a source. However, of course, ideally, you are a source who is invested in developing amazing leadership skills. But to your back to your question of transmission, when transmission takes place, the most beautiful way is to do it with a ritual, right? And to really make sure that both the original source and the receiving source, the succeeding source, are ready. You know, they have had conversations about this. They have a shared understanding about what is the unchangeable part about what I'm handing over. And in many ways, we would say it's most deeply connected to the values of the founding source. And secondary, it's about the vision or the product or what exactly this needs to be. And we can see this, for example, very beautifully in a number of Japanese companies. Many of them, you know, I think of the 1,000 oldest companies on the planet, 500 are Japanese. So they have really figured out this transmission of source. How do you make something that lasts over generations? The values are all still very much alive in these organizations, but they might have pivoted entirely what kind of product or service they're offering today. So, right, there is something about the transmission that is unchangeable, and then there is a lot about the transmission that is changeable and that needs to change over time because of changing conditions. Another way source can be transmitted is if a source just sort of drops a baton, right? And that sometimes happens where, you know, I might go, I'm just done. I don't want to do this anymore. So I drop everything, I go, and I know that this happened if I really don't care anymore, right? If it dies, if it lives, I don't mind. And then in this case, if a person from within the original field picks up the baton, they are actually now beginning to build something new, right? So it may look as if they're continuing something because the field still exists and the infrastructure still exists. But from an energetic perspective, if the original source really dropped the baton and you pick it up, then now it's your creation, right? And might still be informed by things that you've known from the old system, but it's really a new birth. And then there are a lot of instances in, again, in family-owned organizations in particular, where, let's say, you know, grandmother or grandfather was the original source for this initiative. Then they hand over the CEO chair to somebody from the next generation, daughter, son, some relative, but they never actually handed over source. And then you notice in this field, when an important decision has to be made, everybody sort of still turns to the original source and goes, what would they say about this? Right? And in these cases, then what often happens is that only the next generation actually receives the full transmission of source, because the original source is just too tired to carry on, but it nearly skips a generation, right? So there are these different ways of how this can happen, but you know, the more intentional it is being orchestrated, the more beautiful for the entire system. And, you know, and the first and this sort of well, successor source included, of course.
So I imagine, therefore, having a conversation about source in an organization or in a project is, you know, fundamentally important, because I think implicitly a lot of people may, you know, recognize what you're talking about, but an explicit conversation about it could unleash, and this is where my question goes, could unleash incredible capabilities that, you know, and part of that conversation is acknowledging source acknowledging their source, and maybe seeing where they were not able to own source, where they're abdicating, and also that there are, and I, this is also part of the question, There are other sources that could be there inside of a project if it's big enough. You know, that's where my thinking goes. That, you know, what do you see? So I'm at, anyway, I'm asking a couple of questions in a sense, like, what do you see happening when the kinks around source are kind of smoothed out? There's clarity, there's plugging in, and when multiple sources can be acknowledged inside of projects.
So maybe let me preempt it with something that can often be a pushback, especially now in, newer organizations, newer initiatives that, if we looked at them from a spiral dynamics perspective, are very much driven by sort of a green meme, right? There's often resistance to the source idea there for, for all the right reasons, because there is a fear that we're just reintroducing the patriarchy through the back door. Right. However, I would really like to invite the perspective of I don't think at all that's the case, right? And the reason why I don't think it's the case is patriarchy and sort of the traditional hierarchies that we see in traditional organizations, they're built on a maxim of power over, right? You have to do something just because I say so. A source-driven field is built on the maxim of power with. So the idea is also the only way to grow my field is if I am attractive in my message to other sources who want to join me in this endeavor, and who at least partially feel they can realize their own life vision underneath my umbrella. Yeah, that doesn't mean that all of their creative energy has to be poured into this field, but at least some of their creative energy. And if they join me in this capacity as sources, they become, within the logic of this sacred order, what we would call specific sources or subsources, who are then responsible for something they are sourcing within my field or underneath my umbrella, whichever, image works for you. And then my role as a global source is to give them all the freedom that they need to realize their vision, right? And to my earlier point, if my pathology is flip-flopping between abandonment and micromanagement, that's a sh foolproof way to alienate sources, right? Because the one thing that unites most sources that I know is they have a vision. They don't want to be micromanaged. They want to have access, ideally, to the resources that they need to realize that vision. And they're very values driven, right? And if we align enough around our values, like if I can portray to you what are my founding values, and you go, actually that tracks. Like there's enough in my value set to know that this is a good home for me for the time being. Then you will happily realize your vision under my umbrella. And then maybe, just to name the other potential position you can have in a field is the role of a helper. And a helper is a person who, can also be equally inspired by the vision of the source and really believe, and this is an amazing endeavor. This is something that should be in the world. I want to support this. But I come in more with a, with this energy of let me understand exactly what you need me to do so that I can do exactly those things. And I don't, have this grand vision for what this needs to be on my own. I just want to get clear instructions so that I know, do I hit the mark or do I not hit the mark? And because of my, current position in life and, maybe I just have a new family, whatever it is, I might also be at a point where I don't have the internal capacity right now to access this source energy, or I don't feel called to do it in this particular field. Yeah, so to not discount helpers, but say helpers are amazing people and we need them left and right. And also, there is fluidity in which role I can take in which part of the initiative. So I might be sourcing a particular sub-initiative and at the same time show up as a helper in the sub-initiative of another source and vice versa, right? So these are not fixed. And I would say each of us, and that's where we connect again to the inner work piece, because we also sometimes need to do inner work to be good helpers. right? And to find it within us to submit ourselves fully and with joy under the leadership and the vision of another person. And that's also a quality.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Before I ask you about, actually, I want to go first to the connection between source and money, and then maybe we'll unpack money in the in that. But what do you think is the most important question around this whole topic people can ask themselves right now?
Around source and money.
Around source, first of all, yeah, around, you know, yeah.
Well, around source, I would say what you need to become aware of is your relationship with authority and power. Yeah, because that's often where friction arises. Because most of us, the way we've been socialized, we have at some point or other made negative experiences with power and authority, namely in the shape of we were subjected to a power over situation. We were subjected to people who had abused their power and influence over us. And at some point in our development, we either made the decision, I will never be like that. So, going back to the metaphor of the inner house, we've closed off the rooms within ourselves where we have authority and power because we find them hugely undesirable. Or we have become copycats, right? And we sort of made the conclusion, well, clearly to get ahead in life at all, this is what you need to exercise, right? That's where you need to go. And that's where I think we see a lot of sort of the toxic leadership that is popping up now, especially with the permission of the Trump administration to move into that space fully, right? And I think it's having a global ripple effect of all of these leaders who now say, well, see, I'm glad, so the DIEB woke inclusive stuff is over. Let's get back to business. And who step into their power and authority rooms, but without any connection to the balancing rooms of being powerless, being submissive, having that to balance them. And I would say I always think of a lying eight, right? Sort of an infinity symbol. And the inner rooms in the house that I explore with my clients, I always explore two. So the polarity. So if we're exploring your power room, we're also exploring your disempowered room. Right. So there's something about that as a starting point for reflection around source that I find quite helpful.
And following, like you said, helping
Yeah.
that if I, it's like with my yes and my no, if I don't land in my no around a decision,
Yeah.
then I can't inhabit my yes fully. So
Absolutely. Right. So, and to name maybe a few more polarities. So, yes and no is a hugely important one, leading, following, inclusion, exclusion. Yeah. So all of these come in pairs, and it's really, really important to realize to allow source energy to flow. Both sides of a polarity need to be accessible for me and joyful for me. As long as one of them is off limits and taboo, I create an energy block.
let's and you mentioned energy block, which makes me think of money and the connection between source and money. Let's go up to the connection first. What's important about the connection between source and money? And that might lead you to say what you feel money is as well. I know you write beautifully on that, but what's important about this connection?
Well, I mean, I think the first connection that most people have experienced is that money often shows up as a problem for a source, right? They feel if I only had the money, then I could realize X, right? And that's where we often fall into the first trap, which we now see a lot, at least in the teams that I'm supporting, where a source says money is an issue, so let me find investors. Then they bring in investors and then the shit show unfolds, right? Because suddenly people who brought in money feel they have a right to make decisions. So they override the wisdom of the source and you have power struggles. Sometimes the source is driven out of their field entirely. It creates all kinds of unhealthy environments. So, I want to quote Peter here again, who always says something to founders. He says, listen, money is never the problem and it's never the solution. Yeah, so if we move in our understanding beyond this fixation on money, we actually realize the reason why people join a field is because of a vision. It's because of who you are as a source. It's because they feel inspired to contribute with and without money. And if you wanted to build a source-driven field, that might also be a healthy starting point to not pick the people who, you know, first start with the negotiations around their fee or their, you know, what their shares or whatever it might be, but who start with a conversation about inspiration. So that might be a good starting point to build something healthier. And then realize money is one of those amazing entry points into your inner house, because I have not met another topic yet that points you as quickly towards your still locked rooms as money. So money is the last frontier, you know, and I often say in terms of our spiritual development, I really feel, you know, that's the conversation we need to have. Right. And right now I'm, you know, part of different networks with really amazing individuals. And in one of them, you know, there's a lot of sort of ex-finance people in that group. Some people with significant amounts of wealth and sort of, you know, financial abundance in their lives. And they much rather talk about incredibly woo-woo stuff, you know, from telepathy to alien transmission to Aztecs and what that means for our life today. But the one thing we don't talk about is money. Right, because that's where the transformation stops in a way, right? And if you ask them, would you be willing to invest in an endeavor because you believe in it, but without getting a return on investment financially, most of them will say no, right? So our addiction to money, what we feel we need to have in terms of money for it to be enough, what we feel financial success says about our success as a person in society, if we don't unwrap that, there will forever be some rooms in our inner house that are off limits, and that blocks your source energy.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm just reminded of the quote I shared with you, and I've forgotten who said this, but you know, the quote is something like, it's easier to see the end of the world than the end of capitalism.
Yeah.
And I find that to be true. And there's something, because of course I don't want to come here and attack capitalism outright. Obviously there are issues with our current economics system, without doubt. But it's a construct as well, you know. It's at least it's a human-made construct, whereas, you know, our planet is something entirely different. It's governed by laws of nature, and there are finite resources and, you know, consequences of our actions, and yet still we're unable to maybe make certain decisions that you know, ethically, morally are kind of no-brainers in one sense. But so. This is such a rich topic. Do you feel there's so many questions again? If we stay on a more higher level, do you feel that it's like becoming time now for us to examine money in a closer way? Do you feel like people are opening to that? Because, you know, again, excuse me for adding just one last, it's like maybe are we getting to a place where we recognize that we've constructed money in a specific way with it's like a deep belief, a structure of society, and we can take perspective on it.
Yeah. So yes, absolutely. I think it's time. I see signs that this is a conversation that people are more excited to have. And I want to quote somebody here who I really admire. His name is Christian Felber, and he is an Austrian economist who developed something that is called economy for the common good. And it's a whole model that could potentially replace capitalism, right? And he says when he travels to economic forums and economic summits and all of that, you know, those kind of events, he's always met with, he uses an acronym, TINA. So there is no alternative to capitalism. right? And he says we counteract it with the acronym TAPAS. There are plenty of alternative solutions. And he says the economy for the common good and the model that he developed is just one of them. Another one might be donut economics, right? So there are plenty of models now who say, you know, this is not the end of economics, but it's the end of looking at what do we need to consider when we talk about an economics that also includes our shared resources, the commons, right? Our planet, the health of this planet, the health of other species, and doesn't just write them off as externalities like capitalism that are unsustainable in the long run. So I do think we need to open our viewpoint and really research what are other ways of being in exchange with one another where everybody has the right and the capacity to flourish. Because what we're seeing right now is sort of the, you know, that maybe the, hopefully the inflection point of hyper capitalism, where the gap between the haves and the have-nots has reached a really a painful, unsustainable level. And, you know, my word of warning there is, I don't know who came up with this metaphor, but I really like it. Somebody once said, it's like we're all on this big ocean cruise, right? And this cruise ship has a million different levels. It's enormous, right? Some of them are like floating cities. Now, if you're sitting on the upper deck in your, you know, amazing ocean view suite, right? You have a different viewpoint, and you know, life looks very comfortable from up there. And if the ship is hitting an iceberg, right, the first people who will notice and who will die are the people on the lower decks and, you know, in the engine room. Like that's where the water will enter first. But make no mistake, you're still sitting on the same ship, right? So if this tanker goes down, you're going to drown as well. And I think that's, you know, sort of the minimum reason why we should all be interested in finding alternative models, because this ship will sink. And if people in the lower ranks are going to drown, nobody on the upper decks will be safe in the long run. So, how do we develop a deeper compassion for one another and a deeper interest in making sure that everybody has a dignified life on in all places on the planet? Now, the new economic models out there, there's some really amazing entry points into that, right? Some really, really smart people, much smarter than I, have come up with amazing ways of thinking through this and practicing it already at different points in different points on the planet. However, the one viewpoint that very few of them have yet embraced is that perhaps to really make these new models work, we first need to understand and examine our own personal relationship with money. Because if we don't understand that, we are going to replicate the same shadows into new systems. And I think one good example is, for example, you know, when blockchain came about and Bitcoin was on the rise, you know, some people really had this idea like this will set us free, right? We will be free of the, you know, the banks, of the national reserves, all of those things. We can do our own thing and we will democratize access to financial flows. But what happened is that it just became another financial instrument, another way to get rich without working, right? Another way to play the game and to win. So our greed has found a wonderful way into these new systems as well, and I think we will continue doing that until we understand on a deeper level what money actually is.
Let's go there now, because that the societal systemic nature of money is incredibly complex and you know, beyond my scope of expertise by quite some way in terms of being able to justify it being the, you know, the podcast host. But the what you just pointed to is like the our inner relationship to money and what is money. Let's go there. So what is money to you? And then we can explore, yeah, some of the common patterns you see around people's struggle, you know, patterns with money, basically.
So perhaps, again, to sort of dip into history and into the source of this, as I mentioned at the very beginning, it was again Peter Koenig who started sort of this kind of exploration into what is money and the work that is needed to heal our relationship with money. So when Peter worked with organizations and individuals, he was just flabbergasted to see, just this minute we had dialogue about the vision for an organization, the future for the planet, the next generations. We talked about values and all of these amazing things, and we're vibing together in the best way possible. And then suddenly everything shifted once money hit the table. And once money hit the table, people started getting into arguments. They started talking about return on investment. They started to talk about budgets and what's in the budget and what's not in the budget, and everybody energetically contracted. And he's like, what the hell just happened? We just had these amazing conversations about visions and changing the world, and now we're back to budgets and return on investment. So he became interested in the question you just asked me, well, what is money? Right? And when we ask that question, if you have a room of 30 people and you were to write down everybody's responses on a flip chart, you have 40 different responses. And on this flip chart, you'll have everything from money is the root of all evil to money is freedom, from people with money destroy the planet to money is security, right? To money is love even. So you have all of these varying responses, and if all of that is money, it brings us back to the originating question of, well, but what is money? So what Peter discovered on his trajectory of researching money was, money is actually only one thing. Money is a projection screen. Right, money is a human invention that we created to serve a specific purpose. It has sort of overcome us in not serving this purpose anymore, but actually ruling our every moment of every day. It rules our relationships, from personal to business relationships. It rules everything that we do over the course of a day, our work life. But why? Right? If money isn't real, if we invented it, couldn't we tell a different story? We can, but we need to understand what we're projecting onto this projection screen that is money. And he discovered that we essentially have three types of different projections. So, firstly, what we're projecting onto money is human stuff, right? We're projecting human qualities onto this projection screen of money. And we, of course, also project human qualities onto things other than money, right? That could be our partners and our relationships. It could be our boss. It could be institutions. It can really be anything, because human life is one big projection. However, since money is something that influences all of our aspects of life, it has become one of the major projection screens for humans. So the first thing to recognize is, what is it that I'm projecting? Human stuff, human qualities, because money is neither dirty nor is money free, right? Money is just a hammer, and then it looks for a nail, right? So you can either use it to bash in somebody's head, or you can use it to hang up a picture. So money is really what you want it to be. Money is what you see in it. And what Peter discovered in this investigation of sort of, he really came from a Carl Gustav Jung perspective, looking at projections and shadow work and all of that. He found that there are, in principle, three main projection types. So one projection type is people who have unconscious positive projections on money. So if you really dig deep, they really do think money is freedom, money is security, money is love. Now, if that's your deepest held belief, then what essentially happened is you have dissociated your own human capacity to be free, to be secure, to be love, and you projected it outwards onto money. And now the obvious conclusion is, to have all of these things, you need to have money, right? So the shadow that you drop into is the shadow of greed, because money now becomes a target, but unfortunately, it's a moving target. So, it's just yesterday having a conversation with a bunch of investors and wealth managers and sort of inheritors of family offices. And one of them quoted a study that was done with millionaires and billionaires where they were asked, what is enough, right? When do you feel you have enough? And the answer in all cases was minimum double of what they currently had or triple of what they had, regardless of what they had. So that tells us that the moment you're approaching a sum that once was sort of the golden number for your exit, where you could then finally be free and do what you love to do and not worry about making money anymore, that target shifts. So it's literally like the carrot that somebody tied to your head, right? And you're running after this carrot, but you can never reach it. So if you have positive projections, you're in the hamster wheel, the carrot is tied to your head, and you run faster and faster and faster. And what you're actually producing is sort of a vicious cycle, because now you're often trapped in a way of working that doesn't make you happy. Yeah. So you don't love what you're doing. The promise is that one day you'll have enough money to make that all stop, step out of the hamster wheel and do what you love. But that's not happening because of the carrot tied being tied to your head. So what you do instead is you put on band-aids, and the band-aids you put on are things you can consume, right? And the more you consume, the faster the hamster wheel has to turn, because suddenly you have, two cars and two houses and, whatever, two wives that you need to support, whatever that is. And but you can't get out of the wheel anymore. Now, and that interacts with people who have unconscious negative projections on money. So if you really dig deep into their psyche, they would say, money is awful. Money is dirty. Money is the root of all evil. People with money destroy the planet. People with money are all liars and manipulators. Now, if that's your deepest held belief about money, you don't run after money. You actually push money away. Right. So you're constantly in the minus because a part of you is busy with keeping all of that away from yourself, because you do not want to be any of these things and not be near any of these things. So your shadow is disgust in a way, right? And it's sort of a holier than thou attitude to money. Like, you don't want this evil thing in your life. And the sad movement you create is actually that you push the money right into the hands of the first type I described, of people who have positive projections on the money, because they can't have enough of this substance. And so you're serving them just well. And then we have a third type. We lovingly call them the washing machine, because in this sort of spin cycle, they sort of flip-flop between greed and disgust, because they have a little bit of both. They have some unconscious positive projections on money and some unconscious negative projections on money. And then they often end up being impact investors if they have some money, right? Because they now say, I want to do good with the money that I've made. And, I do want to change the world, but only as long as not some insecurity is triggered in them. Because the moment that happens, they flip-flop to the other side, and suddenly it's all about the bottom line and their return on investment. In my line of work, I don't know if you've experienced that, when I support clients who have investors, that's often the experience they make, because they have this Jekyll Hyde kind of situation where they never quite know who's the investor I'm going to talk to tomorrow. Is it the guy who wants to support my vision, or is it the guy who asks me about my return on investment and puts on the thumb screws to make me work harder and faster? Right. So all of these patterns, the positive projections, the negative projections, the mixed projections, as long as we're unaware of them, they actually wreak havoc with our lives. And as long as we're unaware of them, no matter what new system we build, we're always going to reintroduce the same shadows in the new system.
They're incredibly powerful articulations of these different types, of different types of people. Is there, do you have a view of someone who is free from those? Before we talk about the path towards, towards that freedom, is it, is there a view of someone who has a kind of liberated, I don't know how you would put it, how you would call that, but they've done that inner work and now they're in a different place.
Yes, I don't think there are very many people like that yet, but there are many people like me who I would say I'm well on my path, but I still do get triggered at times, right? But I would say a person who's truly free, they don't mind either way. in a way, right? They're equally happy with having money and spending money and saving money as they are with not having money. So they have undone the addiction to money that we've all been injected with by the nature of the capitalist system we were raised in. And it is, by the way, quite interesting to talk to people who come from countries where they were raised in socialism or mainly I would say socialism, because they sometimes still do hold a slightly different perspective, right? So they haven't been drinking quite the same Kool-Aid as people who grew up in the democratized Western societies that have been driven by capitalism. So there are people on the planet who hold different positions now, but for the most part, I would say we have an unhealthy addiction to money, and somebody who's really done the inner work fully just doesn't have this addiction to money anymore. They're really free to see a hammer as a hammer and go, I can do anything with a hammer. So let's play, right? And the other part that I would say is they don't see the fulfillment of their purpose as tied to money, because they are on this path either way. Sometimes with money and sometimes without money, and they're not bothered.
Yeah, because a common in our field in particular, I've seen this, and in business, that this kind of idea that, and I think there's a truth to this, but it's complicated that if you create something of value, if you have skills, then you'll make money from it. Your people will see that and they'll want it, and that's a measure of your maturity and development and quality. And I can see a truth to that, and it probably drives innovation, but I can see how it's complicated, and this perspective that you're bringing is not acknowledged at all in that view. It's partly driven by our unconscious beliefs around what having money is, so therefore, could you talk about a little bit about the path of liberate, how one, so awareness is key, being aware. Do I have a positive projection, negative projection, or a mixed projection? And then is it, what modalities would be helpful here? Is it, could you do things like parts work, or kind of integrative modalities that help divest, no pun intended, divest the kind of attachment and identification with those projections?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think there are different paths to get there. And I myself have been trained in a modality called voice dialogue, right, which has some overlap with IFS. So there are different ways we can approach parts work that can definitely help. However, the money work process that Peter Koenig developed, I would say, is a little bit of an inner parts work on steroids, because it's much faster. But it speaks to the same principle, because I would say any modality that works essentially does the same thing, which is it opens up rooms in our inner house that we could previously not step into, right? So, and with money, what we're doing is, and let me give you a very easy example. So, if I have a positive projection on money, and I would say, money is freedom, then the sentence around money, I take it and I replace the word money or even people with money, and I replace it with the word I, right? So a positive projection might be money's freedom. Then I try saying I am free, and I notice, and now this is where the process begins. I notice, is there an embodied reaction to that sentence? What do I notice happens in my body when I say this sentence? If this sentence has resonance in my biography, I will feel something, right? Either sort of a feeling of letting go and opening up, or a feeling of contraction somewhere, disbelief, maybe even numbness, right? So different reactions can show up. Same with a negative projection. If I say, money is the root of all evil, I would do the same thing. I replace the word money with the word I go, I am the root of all evil. And I begin to see, is that a room in me that is accessible? Because you could argue as a human being, that's true, right? I mean, we are the people who are screwing up the planet right now. So I am the root of all evil. Can I be comfortable with that? And then we move into finding the polarity. So, if I am free is one side of the polarity, then how does it feel to say I'm unfree? Is that something I can be comfortable with? And likewise with the negative projection, if the sentence was, I am the root of all evil, can I say, I am the root of all good, or whatever the polarity happens to be for me, right? And so the process of money work is one where we use language as an entry point into a bodily reaction, a sort of a emotional and body reaction. So we test that with the client. And then there's a certain process to begin to open up the rooms. And it's a little bit different for positive and negative projections, but that would maybe go too far at this point. But the outcome is that you not only recognize that you have both spaces in you, but you're able to recognize the value that comes out of both spaces, even the space that you've denied yourself because you felt, this is not who I am or who I want to be.
So, in a sense, there's a metabolization of the embodiment of a particular projection,
Yeah.
through surfacing it into awareness,
Right.
owning that projection, and then feeling the resonance of that ownership, and that bringing it into awareness is what is able to kind of liberate, you begin to alchemize or metabolize the frequency of that projection.
Yeah. Exactly. Until a point where, neither sentence that describes one of the two polarities is triggering to you anymore. You know that it's integrated when you go, yeah, okay, I'm the root of all evil. And yeah, and I'm the root of all good. Yeah. So, and both feel absolutely fine in my system. Then these two rooms have been reintegrated, they're inhabitable again. And depending on context, I can step into one or the other and leverage sort of what power lies in either. So that's the process.
And to me, this is just a beautiful pointing to shadow, to shadow
Yeah.
work. And I'm struck by how, coming back to the connection between source and money, in a sense, like there's such a beautiful marriage because, like as you described, money is just so ubiquitous. It's just, so embedded within our experience of being human. And therefore, it's allowing us to open up these rooms, and as we do so, we're able to, unblock, kind of just metaphorically unblock the kinks that would disrupt the flow of sourcing through people into projects in the world. And so I can see that as we were, if we were able to do this work in larger numbers, it would, it could create, it could unleash more source into the world.
Yeah, it could unleash more source energy overall. And I also feel it really is the next frontier of our spiritual development, right? To really get to a point of being able to access my full potential, money, at least at this point in our shared developmental process, is that next frontier. So I really, really, I'm loving to see that this work is gaining more traction right now, that there are more and more people sort of realizing how essential, how fundamental money and source work are. And even just a couple of weeks ago, Peter and I did a, yeah, if you want, top team process for the founders of the Inner Development Goals, because they realized that is actually the humus on which all of the inner development goals rest, right, is the foundation of money and source. And if they don't touch that level, none of the other work really takes root. Yeah, so I do feel the time has come for people to really, embrace that and explore that. And you know, the coaches that I have seen, that I have trained, I feel that their work has gained so much richness once they tapped into these sort of core layers of development.
It does feel, as you've articulated, that we've reached the end, or we're moving through a particular phase in our cycle around capitalism, and that's making money louder, you know. And if I'm thinking of people like Nate Hagans, who has talked about the actually that, you know, our financial systems are a bit of a smokescreen on top of energy, you know. It's our access to energy that's allowed us to become incredibly wealthy, and that the kind of returns on extracting that energy are starting to diminish. So that's going to have quite an impact on our economic prosperity. And you know, it's not really clear exactly what impact it will have, but if you listen to Nate, it's pretty damn sobering. It's like, and so I see it becoming a louder and louder topic. And there are po he names positive benefits that it will force. It could, because this is all, who knows what other things might emerge, but it could force a kind of deep reconsideration of what it means to be human, back towards, you know, particular values of connection and
Absolutely. And you know,
intimacy.
to just name that, the underlying vision that Peter has shared with the world is actually that we shift from what he calls the normal regime, where we're essentially all trapped in our own version of the hamster wheel that I described before, that is driven forward and faster by consumption and sort of the, you know, trying to fill a gap of meaning through money that we make. And instead, he says, we need to step into what he calls the natural regime, which is very much sort of a regenerative way of living and being that looks at, you know, what are truly my needs? What brings me meaning in life? And to start from that point and then see the money I need to make to live that kind of life is probably much more modest than the money I needed in you know, the quote unquote normal regime, because in the natural regime, I'm nourished, like wealth means something entirely different, right? I redefine what wealth means to me. And I feel, you know, maybe something to share with your community as well that we're stepping into now for the next rounds of CU Money and CU Source, the programs that we have around this, we have decided to step away even from the sliding scale model that we had in the past, where, you know, we've always worked with, you know, not everything needs to, well, know how to put this, that fairness doesn't lay in everybody paying the same price, because we all have very different capacity financially, time-wise, et cetera, that factors into what fair is to us. But we're now taking it a step further, and beyond an initial registration fee, we actually make the process of eventually coming to the right number for you and for us, that is a shared process, right? So we really have conversations about money, and then one sort of celebration in which that happens in a big way over a video conference, where we share numbers, we get naked, we get transparent, we talk about needs and we talk about fears and we talk about wants, and we come to the number that is right for each of us in the end, and essentially together create a new money story. And for us, that's an experiment too. Yeah, but at the same time, I feel we've done all the foundational work to make us uniquely qualified to have that conversation with our participants. And I'm really excited to see where that leads us, right? Because that is a needs-based economy that moves entirely away from this, you know, sort of supply and demand logic that we've been indoctrinated with.
Yeah. This has been such a rich conversation, Nadia, and I think I'd love to, maybe this is a place where we draw it to a close, and you could also share about more of where we can, we can find out about your work and what you're creating. And before that, I wonder, is there anything you would like to end by saying? You've shared so much, you've been so generous, but if there's anything else.
Yeah, I'd love to share something that I came across recently that maybe puts all of this in, the wonderful framework before we started. You sort of grounded us in a bigger vision. And I wonder if you want to repeat that, what you said with to me, because then I can link my thing to that.
Yeah, great. I will. It's interesting because I notice I feel a bit vulnerable about it because it I often start with, so this points to some of my inner work around potentially around sourcing, actually around I have this caveat of saying I don't mean this to sound grandiose. But actually if I put that aside, if I love that part, just acknowledge that part of me. My highest intention for this podcast is that we align with, we open to sourcing energy, to the flow of the evolutionary impulse that moves through human beings, that moves through beings in general and through life, and that it's a way of life evolving between two people. And you can feel that. You can feel, I it's not with every podcast, but I feel it with us, and it's like a sense of source, to use the language. So that's my intention for these podcasts. It's part of the evolution of consciousness.
And I thought that was so beautiful for you to share that and to give it that context. And I wanted to share something with you at the beginning, but perhaps that's a good closing point. So I would call myself a spiritual person with, sort of quotation marks, because I never completely knew what do I mean by that, right? Because I've never followed any particular spiritual school. I've never really connected to most spiritual teachers that are out there. I found value in some aspects of them, but often the whole gurudom around them, like there were always aspects that didn't fully resonate with me. And then recently, a friend of mine, Tom Morgan, introduced me to a spiritual teacher by the name of Tim Freake, and we can share
I'm very
links.
familiar with his work. Yeah,
You're
beautiful.
familiar with him.
I love what he's bringing. Yeah,
Yeah,
very
he's.
important. Yeah.
So, in a nutshell, with my still very limited understanding of his model, but he speaks to something that you put into the space when we started, because he said, contrary to also what I have believed and sort of propagated in the 34 books that I wrote, and he did write 34 books before this one. He said, I used to believe, in the beginning there was God. And in a way, what all the spiritual models teach us is, we've lost this connection to God, and our whole process of enlightenment is to find our way back to that and to leave our ego behind and merge again with this oneness. And he said, my understanding after years and years and years of investigation and studying is actually now quite different. He said, I do believe in the beginning there was one, but there wasn't an intelligence. There wasn't a God. It was just sort of an undifferentiated emergence of life. And the process, he says, the process of evolution, the way I understand it now, is actually a process of unfolding, a process of becoming, a process of increasing differentiation. And one of these strands of differentiation of life is what we are as human beings. And in our process of differentiation, we didn't just develop our own senses, but we also developed psyche, which for him is another sense, which allows us to be in relation to our inner processes that are running all the time in the background, right? So we can have a relationship to ourselves. We can, make ourselves object of our investigation, our inquiry. And he says the next sense that he sees is being developed on the planet is what he calls a psi sense, right? So the ability to sense ourselves and to sense others. And he says, now what I think happens when people go, for example, in these profound states of meditation, and they meet something that they feel is God or is love, he says, I think that's what we're beginning to co-create through size sensing, right? So we're moving from a place of being an individual to a place where we can experience ourselves as a univigil. And so the univigil is actually what creates God. We are creating God. We are in the process of creating that which we experience as oneness, from a different viewpoint. But within that, and that's why I love it so much, it's not about shedding our individuality, but realizing that our individuality is what gives this particular flavor at this point of the oneness. Our experiences are all channeled into this new oneness, right? So our experiences, our choice, that it all matters. And so aptly, his new book is called Why Your Life Matters. And I'm a huge fan of that perspective, and I really, really love seeing myself and you and this conversation as part of this process of becoming and exploring the shape of our unividuality through that. So I'm personally very happy that I found him, and very excited that you have also been following his work.
Yeah, I just want to. I mean, it's beautiful you bring it in. And I think he's pointing, what he's pointing to is an antidote as well to an avenue I went down, actually without my control in some sense, but like a radical non-duality and a neo-Advaitin, perspective of like no self, like you don't exist
Yeah.
and the world is an illusion.
Right.
And there are growing communities of people recovering from that perspective. And I love what he said about, one day he said, would I tell my daughter these things? Would I say to her, you don't exist and the world doesn't exist, it's an illusion? And he was like, no. So
Yeah.
just wanted to add that little bit onto what you're sharing to
Yeah.
encourage people to check him out.
Yeah. So to check him out, and I see, though, and this is where I see sort of pieces of the puzzle fitting together, right? Because one of the questions he answers in his work is sort of, how do we get there, right? How do we train our size sensing? How do we bring people closer to this experience of being a univigil and not just an individual? And he says, well, it's through building good people, right? Is through character building, is through helping people. And I, in my language now, I would say the groundwork we need to do is the inner housework, right? Is the integration of all things human. Because then the progression is, the first step for me is always this amazing discovery of, oh my God, I have an inner house, right? I acknowledge the internal complexity of the thing that is I. The next step is to realize, oh my God, you, Joel, you have an inner house. Oh my God, all the beautiful complexity in you, right? The next step is to discover, oh, we live in the same inner house. Wow, right? And maybe the final step is to discover, actually, there's no inner house. And that's maybe when we've reached a state of oneness, right? But so I feel that one of the entry points into this capacity to size sense, this capacity to experience ourselves as individuals, is actually all the inner work that you and I and people that are listening now, that we are propagating. It's part of this path of becoming, of this flourishing into God. And that gives it a wonderful frame, I think.
Big virtual high five for that. I think it's a, I'm really glad I asked that question because I think it's a beautiful invitation that you just shared, actually. And I know I'm pretty sure it'll resonate with many of our listeners. So, yeah, Nadia, I feel really grateful that we've been able to get connected and to have you on the podcast. And, I think this is a really important invitation, this whole podcast to an essential part of work we're being invited to do. So, yeah, where can we find out more about what you're up to?
Find me on LinkedIn, Nadia Stataranchevsky. We'll put it in the notes because nobody can type that. It's on our website, conscious-u.com or cu-money.com or cu-source.com. So we have these programs. Again, we're now in this amazing process of experimenting with contributions to the program. So I think it's also an exciting time to join us. There are also, wonderful other practitioners in Peter Koenig's community. So my friend Tom Nixon wrote a book about Source called How Work with Source. I have a friend, Stefan Merkelbach, who wrote The Little Red Book about Source. So those are great resources to tap into. There's an organizational development collective called Greater Than. There's a really great interview that the Source of Greater Than, Francesca Pick, did with Peter Koenig on Source. I'm happy to link that. So I can give you a bunch of links where people can dig deeper into this work and continue this path of exploration. I can only say I think it will enrich your unfolding in many ways.
Thank you, Nadia.
Thank you, Joel. This was so amazing. Thank you for the great preparation and great questions.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.